Hello, everyone, and welcome to McGill Care's webcast series, Supporting Family and Informal Caregivers. I'm Claire Webster, a former caregiver, certified dementia care consultant, and founder of McGill University's Dementia Education Program. I work with a dynamic team of leading healthcare professionals to oversee the program, who include Dr. José Moret from the Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Dr. Serge Gauthier, Professor Emeritus, formerly of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging. McGill Cares is supported by the Amelia Saputo Community Outreach for Dementia Care. The McGill Dementia Education Program offers a comprehensive range of free resources to educate and support persons living with dementia, family and informal caregivers, healthcare professionals, medical students, and the public at large. One of our most important resources is our Dementia Companion Guide, which can be downloaded for free. Printed copies are available on Amazon, and it is now available in 12 different languages. We also have all kinds of other amazing resources, including a new program that we launched last week, which are video capsules to engage and encourage people living with dementia to participate in leisure and recreation activities. So please go and check out our website. So today's topic is talking to children about dementia and dying. This is a topic that we have been wanting to address on McGill Cares for a long time, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today, Andrea Warnick. She is a registered psychotherapist and registered nurse who supports individuals, families, and communities who are grieving illness and death in their lives. She co-owns AWC, a group practice of over 30 therapists who provide grief therapy across Ontario and grief consultation and education across Canada. She developed and teaches the five-day certificate program in children's grief and bereavement at Sick Kids Center for Community Mental Health and hosts Kids Grief Q&A, a free monthly forum through the Canadian Virtual Hospice, where she responds to questions from families and professionals from across the country about supporting grieving children and youth. I really encourage everyone to go and have a look at the Canadian Virtual Hospice, by the way. It is an amazing resource for anyone. So Andrea Warnick joins me today to answer questions about how to speak to children about grave illnesses and how to recognize and address grieving in children. Welcome to McGill Cares.
Thanks so much, Claire. It's lovely to be here.
So I'd like to begin by asking you, what is the best way to talk about a progressive disease like dementia that affects people differently and at a different rate to children?
One of the key principles for talking to children is to talk early to them and to be honest with them. And one of the pieces of advice I give a lot of families is that there's never too early to start these conversations. I also really encourage calling the illness by its name, dementia, Alzheimer's, even for the youngest children, because sometimes what happens is people are quick to say, oh, you know, grandma's sick, which kids have no way to differentiate from, you know, sicknesses that spread across the classroom and everything else. And that's where I find really, even for young children, give it a name, call it dementia, call it Alzheimer's. And then you can use that to help the kids understand some of the changes they're seeing in the person. It's because of the dementia that your dad isn't remembering things as well, or is sometimes really confused or calling you by your brother's name.
So given that everyone's situation can be different, are there any general guidelines for deciding what to say and when?
The general guidelines are, first of all, one of the big ones is, you know, it's an adult responsibility to start these conversations. It's not up to kids to start having and opening up the conversations, you know, and that's when I really encourage that as a guideline, be honest, right? Let kids know that, you know, something's going on with the person that they care about. I find that one of the things that can be really helpful is to be able to say to kids, like, I'm wondering if you've seen any changes in your grandma lately. What are some of those changes? So we can actually bring that out in the open, even when it's difficult to talk about. You know, I find families actually reinforcing this idea that even when hard things happen in our families, we talk about them can be really helpful and build up a lot of trust for kids. You know, so that's a piece to reinforce as well. Yeah, we are seeing some changes in grandma as well. we're talking about those changes and we want to help you understand those changes. And that's where we're going to give it a name. We're going to refer to it as dementia. And really, like, there isn't a too early to have this conversation, Claire. One of the things that I do encourage, you know, if we are talking more early about this, sometimes the person with dementia themselves can be a part of the conversation with talking to kids. And I think that's important. Quite often I find that people with a serious illness in our society get prematurely disconnected from the kids around them. And that's where, whenever possible, I'm really including, when we can, the person with the illness themselves, if they can be a part of that conversation, you know, even if they're just in the room for the conversation and talking to kids as well. And it's not that there's anything scripted for families to say. Generally, I'm encouraging them, call it by its name, call it dementia, explain what that is. You know, it's an illness that affects the brain. It affects the cells of the brain. Even little kids know parts of the body, right? And a lot of kids tend to feel responsible for things in their environment. So naming it and explaining that it's happening on the brain level can really help minimize kids feeling responsible, letting them know it's not their fault, and letting kids know that if they've got any questions at all, they can ask.
So when we're talking about dementia, and I work with a lot of, you know, geriatricians and neurologists, one of the things we say is, you know, that you really want to get to know your patient before disclosing a diagnosis for fear of having a catastrophic reaction, okay? Because in certain cases, you depending on the person may be showing the signs of depression or anxiety. And we're seeing a lot today in children. And I went through with one of my youngest, how, you know, at a very young age, she was going through a lot of anxiety issues. And so are there cases where you parents should exert some caution prior to disclosing what's going on for fear of maybe exasperating a child's existing anxiety or depression?
The part that could be challenging here is that, you know, if we're already seeing changes in the person with dementia, kids are exposed to that. Mm-hmm. So if we're not talking to them about what it is, we're not actually protecting them from the situation. Instead, we've got them in the situation without access to accurate information about what's happening. Mm-hmm. And this is where I try to be really clear with families that, listen, there is no way to do this that is going to, you know, skirt around your child experiencing sorrow about this. Like, that's not pathological. It is completely natural, right? Now, there are tons of kids who have pre-existing anxiety before we even have the situation of somebody having a serious illness in the family. There is literature that's pretty clear. Now, a lot of this is in oncology, but I feel pretty comfortable cross-referencing it, that in families who have open communication, anxiety levels tend to be lower, right? If kids already have pre-existing anxiety, it's not that they're going to not be anxious. And of course, they're going to be upset. But if we're actually seeing changes in the person, or if we've got adults talking about the situation, thinking kids don't know what's going on, that's a situation that can actually make it a lot harder for kids. So what I do say to parents is, like, listen, don't dump more information on your kid than they actually want. Kids have very different informational needs. You may have a four-year-old who wants to know all about dementia and might be asking even, like, is grandpa going to die from this? And a seven-year-old who doesn't want all that information. So you might be having some separate conversations there. But in terms of being honest and giving the illness a name, right, and helping kids understand that the changes they're seeing is because of the dementia, I really encourage families not to wait in having that conversation.
So what's the best way to support, you know, a child, a teen, who may be losing a beloved grandparent or even a parent? Because we are unfortunately seeing a lot of, you know, early onset dementia that are affecting people under the age of 55. So what would be the best, like, what are some of the strategies that to really, you know, along the continuum of care or the continuum of as the person is slowly, you know, as the disease is progressing, whether that be dementia or cancer, and what are some of the strategies that you would employ?
So I want to make sure that that individual child's informational needs are met. And then again, in a family of multiple kids, you can have very different informational needs. But that's where, you know, giving them the information about what's happening, the name, letting them know they can ask any questions, right? If kids are asking questions, I don't want to withhold that information that they're asking about, including if it's the biggie of, are they going to die from this? Mm-hmm. But then there's also a piece about grief, right? And us being able to, as adults, modeling healthy grief for kids. Usually I'm encouraging parents not to necessarily, if it's, you know, the grief is of an intensity that it's knocking you to the ground, that can be really tough for kids to witness because they feel like you're out of control and maybe not able to take care of them. But in terms of the day-to-day, you know, if we're crying or more frustrated or, you know, exhausted, that's really healthy to be able to say to kids, you know, I've got a lot of grief right now because of what's happening in our family with the dementia. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's okay. And that's completely natural. And you're probably going to have a whole bunch of feelings too, right? Mm-hmm. And for some people have to do a lot of mad to get through to the sad, worried. There's all kinds of different things in there. But I really, one of the big pieces for me is that we're teaching kids about grief, that it is a healthy and natural human response, even though it's really difficult, mm-hmm. right? We're giving them ways of getting it out. And we're also explicitly giving them permission to be happy and enjoy life, even while this is happening. And kids tend to do a much better job than adults in juggling both joy and sorrow, where they might have just learned that even a parent has dementia. And they're devastated. And literally 7 minutes later, they're like, can I go play video games? Mm-hmm. Right? And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll share a bit of my own story because I have three children and I was a sandwich generation caregiver. So my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease when I was in my late 30s and my kids were 2, 4, and 9. And the way that I dealt with my grief and stress was through anger, unfortunately. Like I was rip roaring angry all the time. And coping, using coping mechanism, which is wine. And so the anger and the wine was not a good combination. And this did go on for quite a while because there was no, you know, I was one of those people that was trying to mask my feelings, but it was coming out in anger. And it was interesting to see among my three children how they responded. So 2 out of 3 rode with my emotions, but again, my youngest didn't. And it really had an impact on her. And now they're grown up, and I think I spent many years feeling tremendous guilt because it was not a very pleasant home situation because of my anger and and everything. But then, you know, I was having a conversation with them not long ago, and I guess I was carrying all this guilt, and they said, you know what, Mommy, you taught us resilience, you taught us that in life, you know, you taught us resilience, and I said, oh my God, kids, like thank you, but. It was a very tough period, you know, of our life at that time.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. And that's where I find, you know, one of the big things as humans is we want to be able to narrate our life stories, right? And there's no way very rarely is this not going to be a messy experience in terms of the stress on caregivers and being sandwiched and all of these things. And that's where I just like to help kids understand, like, this is a really hard time in our family. But we love each other and we'll take care of each other. And, you know, there might be more anger than usual. You know, there's all kinds of big feelings and things like that happening. But we love you. And I always want to come back to this piece too with kids. I refer to them as the 5 C's, right? This is where you didn't cause this. I could write a book of all the things kids have told me about how they caused the illness or the death in their family. So I'm really explicit. I do not wait for kids to take the lead in telling me they think they're responsible. You didn't cause it. Certainly in the case of dementia, you can't catch it from the person. You also can't cure it. It's not within your control to cure it, mm-hmm. right? If it is a parent, and when I say parent, I mean anybody raising a kid who is dying or who has dementia. I also want to make sure we're addressing who will take care of me, because quite often kids, even if they're in a two-parent family, will quite quickly go to, well, what happens if something happens to my other parent? Mm-hmm. And then a big piece too is how do we stay connected, right? And this is where some of the work is when somebody has dementia. How do you keep kids connected to them so they don't get prematurely disconnected? And after someone dies, what does that look like to stay connected as well?
And so how do we recognize kids' boundaries? So another example would be, you know, when my mother was transferred to the long-term care, I felt it important that my kids come with me every Sunday to visit, you know, my mom. But I realized at a certain point, I think the girls were, I would say around 9 and 11, my son was a little older, but they got to a point where they hated coming because of the smells and the long-term care that my mother couldn't engage anymore. And now working with the clients that I do, I think a lot of people, they have a hard time letting go of what they used to do, because we used to go see grandma every Sunday or whatever, right? But I guess I had to come to a realization, and it was part of the mourning, that I couldn't bring my children anymore. It was too much. Mm-hmm. So comes a time where you just have to say, you know, let go of what used to be, because it's too much for the children.
Yeah, and that can absolutely be a grief process too. I like to do a little digging when that happens. I find sometimes what happens is kids are hesitant to go because they don't know how to be with the person anymore. So they feel really helpless. And so I like to just sort of dig beneath the surface a bit and be like, I'm wondering if it feels really hard to be with grandma now, because it's really tough to interact with her, you know, and you don't know how to. And that's where for some kids, you know, I can give them ideas of what it might look like to be with her and things like that. And there might be a little bit of an opening there. But I certainly don't want to force kids to be at the bedside. I always, for the kids who want to be there, I absolutely encourage that. I'm often reminding people that throughout history, kids were always at the bedside as people were dying. Mm-hmm. Right? In many parts of the world, they still are. And so I certainly, if we hold them back from that, then they're going to imagine what it's like, which is often worse than what's actually happening, even when what's happening is hard. But I certainly don't want to force kids, but I want to invite them. Right? And if they're hesitant, I'm going to sort of explore what the barrier is for them. But even when kids aren't coming to the bedside, there are ways of helping them stay connected. One of my favorite activities, I literally just take a sheet off the linen cart of the nursing home or hospital, or recycle a home duvet, but cutting material into strips and tracing kids' arms with permanent markers. And so they can make a hug, right? And they can decorate it, and then we can bring it into the long-term care home. And so they feel like they can still be connected. And that's one of the things I like to foster in kids too, that there's ways of being connected beyond being physically in the same space, mm-hmm. and helping them figure out what that looks like as well.
So how can we recognize, you know, grief in children when maybe it's heading towards like the wrong direction? Like, are there some warning signs where there needs to be like an intervention made with children?
Yeah, it's part of the challenge with grief, to be honest, because grief is messy, right? There are no neat, tidy five stages. And so it's important to just know that it's a pretty messy process. But certainly if we've got kids, you know, self-harming or talk of suicide, or even, you know, less extreme than that, but if we see them really withdrawing from friends or from activities that they used to love doing, those are things that I'm always keeping an eye out for. I watch, you know, some kids, their grades are really going to go down, but I'm watching just as much for the kids who maybe there's a real sort of emphasis on perfectionism, right? And control for all that they can't control in their life. They sometimes will try to control other areas, whether it's eating, their marks. So I'm watching as much for those kids whose grades are going up. You know, and those are some of the things where we just want to be checking in with them. Some kids, you know, are really going to benefit from being able to talk to somebody outside the family, whether that's a school counselor, whether it's a beloved aunt, whether it's a therapist. One of the things I know about kids is that they are trying to protect their parents, usually as much as parents are trying to protect them, right? And that's why I like to give them an opportunity. Would you like to talk to somebody outside the family? And if you've got somebody who, you know, has some familiarity with grief and things like that, then that can be a bonus.
So I imagine in your practice, I mean, you must work with like a lot of parents, right? Clearly. And what do you recommend to like parents that are grieving and or even perhaps like in my case that we're on the verge of having a complete burnout and like the symptoms and, you know, like what, like, I mean, does it must happen in your practice where you say, okay, you're heading for burnout and this is what you need to do to get through it?
Yeah, I find sometimes in these situations, families are coming to us and they're just saying, support our kids. And we're like, actually, the best thing we could do is support you, you know? And so we really do encourage. Now, I mean, we're all therapists in private practice or whatever. So usually at that point, they're opting in to do individual sessions, which first, not everybody needs it or benefits from it, but certainly can benefit a lot of people to have their own space to unpack how hard this is, right? And so we can work on different ways of coping and supporting themselves through the grief. It's still going to be messy and it's still going to be hard. But what we really are often trying to help happen is that there are healthy ways of expressing it and integrating what's happening. And so that's where we often, you know, are just really saying, how can we help support the caregiver? Because that is such a tough situation to be sandwiched and have dependent children and caring for, you know, parents who are dying or seriously ill. And sometimes it's about getting other organizations involved that can involve, like do some respite and things like that as well. But there's a lot around just also helping normalize for people that like, it is this hard, right? It's not that you're doing this wrong. And we need to find spaces for you where it can be this hard. There's, you know, there's a number of places I know in Ontario where they have rage rooms, right? And some of us, I'm one of these people too, like I am wired. I'm going to get mad before I get sad and I got to get a lot of mad out and then my sad's going to come, right? But actually having places where we can physically, like you can throw stuff. I mean, rage rooms, you got to pay to go do it, but you can, I've got families, Claire, where, you know, punching bags from Canadian Tire that you don't have to mount on the ceiling. They're very easily accessible. And, you know, actually just being like, okay, let's physically take some of this out. You know, I often say, I think a lot of the road rage that we see on the 401 or wherever it is like unprocessed grief where people are just trying to push it to the sidelines and it sneaks up on you. And I'd honestly say that one of the hardest jobs as a grief therapist, whether I'm working with a 6-year-old or whether I'm working with a 66-year-old, is helping them see that there's actually utility in allowing themselves to feel wide range of emotions that come with this experience.
Yeah, we're always trying to suppress our emotions. I mean, I would say often that the only place I would allow myself to cry was in my car.
Yeah.
Right. But we're always trying. I mean, I described it in the past where I was, every time I was feeling an emotion, I would try to swallow my tears.
Yeah.
You know, and so when it would come out twice a year, it was quite cathartic and quite, I mean, it was like that rage that would come out. Right. But you're always, we're always trying, especially women, I feel we're constantly just trying to like, you know, discount how we feel or hold down our emotions and just not, you know, swallow it, you know. And I'm saying women, but men are the same way, probably even worse, right? They're really trying not to show their emotions, right? But eventually, if you don't let them out, they will come out in other ways.
Well, absolutely. And that's where I think we need a real reframe. I'm often trying to teach people, as adults and kids, that one of the bravest, strongest things we can do as humans is allow ourselves to experience the depths of our sorrow. We're designed to actually be able to do this. And I find, you know, I don't think it's too harsh to say we live in a grief illiterate society, you know, and even when you read children's literature and stuff, there's evidence of this idea that feeling our feelings is a weakness. And I think people who identify as male do have extra barriers around that in our society as well. And that's why a lot of the work is helping people see actually finding safe ways to express and process. This isn't verbally for everybody. Some people, it might be writing. Some people, it might be music. Some people, physical activity or a combination of all of those. But doing so ultimately serves you well and often decreases those sort of explosive emotional responses that can happen.
So one more question that I get asked a lot, and I'm sure you do as well, is the topic of funerals. Okay. Yeah. At what age is it too young or is it too young to bring a child to a funeral? And then what about the question of open casket?
Yeah, I really don't believe there is a too young to bring kids to funerals. I'm usually encouraging families, like, make it standard that you bring your kids. And I often will even say, you know, ideally, if there's somebody in your social circle who dies who the kids aren't particularly close to, you know, as long as you think your kids can be respectful at the funeral, bring them so they're learning before it's somebody really close to them. But that's where, you know, bringing kids, the one thing I do say to parents is, you know, if it's you and your parent has died, you may want to have a buddy there with your kids. So if your kids are dysregulated or need to leave, that somebody can do that and you're not walking, feeling like you need to walk out of a funeral for someone you're really close to. But other than that, there's great resources out there. Virtual hospice has a number of them. Like, how do you prepare kids for a funeral? I always want to prepare kids. I want to tell them what's expected. If I know it's going to be an open casket, I mean, the neat thing with kids is like, they're way less anxious about these kind of things than most adults are. Like, I just prepare kids and I say, you know, your person's body, including their head, will all be in a casket, which is actually a box. If you want, you can touch them. You know, they might feel, grandma might feel not as soft as she did. She might feel cold, but that's okay. You know, there's some little things I've learned from years of experience too, where because sometimes the bottom part of the casket is closed, some kids are like, wait, where are their legs? Very concrete thinking. So I like to tell kids their whole body is in there, you know, and just allow them to be a part of that. And to be honest, even with the youngest kids, where people will be like, well, they're two or three, they won't even remember. One of the things I do say is that, and this is more relevant if it's somebody that the child was quite close to, I'll say, but this is an important part of their story. And, you know, I can guarantee you one day they will ask if they were there. It also doesn't mean, Claire, if people didn't bring their kids, that it derailed them or anything else. Sometimes I'm doing rituals with kids years later who, if the child does feel like, I wish I was there and I wasn't, right? But my general advice to families is, bring your kids. There is no too young. You just want to prepare them and you want to make sure you've got some support in place if the kids need to leave and go into another room and do some coloring and stuff like that, so you don't have to leave with them.
Andrea, how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, our website is www.andreawarnick.com. And I can also be found, a bunch of my stuff is on Canadian Virtual Hospice, which is just full of resources. And you could basically just Google me and throw grief in there and a whole bunch of stuff will come.
Well, we will definitely have a link to Canadian Virtual Hospice under the trusted resources of the McGill University Dementia Education Program. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for this conversation, Claire.
So this webcast is an initiative of the McGill University Dementia Education Program, which is funded by private donations. If you would like to make a contribution to our program or for more information, please visit us at mcgill.ca/dementia. And if you would like to join our mailing list to be notified about upcoming episodes of McGill Cares, as well as other important programs and initiatives from us, you can email us at dementia@mcgill.ca. Thank you for watching.